This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Welcome, all our listeners in the U.S. and around the world. You're listening to Baseball Outside the Box, and I am your host, Pete Caliendo. Hey, thanks for joining us. Glad that you can make it on the show. We are excited. This is the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge, the status quo. And we just got back from an exciting trip, Vancouver, Canada. What a beautiful city. Our eighth time there. It's been an honor working with the BC Baseball coaches there, a great organization. What a program. It's a caravan, 3 weeks, 25 cities to promote the game of baseball at the grassroots level. One of the best programs I've ever been involved in that shows how you can actually reach to the grassroots level and develop the sport and increase your participation. It's an educational program where we reach over 500 people. Every city we had gone to, it was really big. We reached parents, players, and coaches, which is important in the development process and understanding the development of young players. And a shout out to our friends there, one of the inventor of the BC Baseball Caravan, our good friend Mike Kelly, and also our coaching staff. They were outstanding. Grant Reimer, Pete Wilkinson from the U.S., Michael Daggs, and Alan Reimer. You guys are great. Loved being with you the whole trip. We had a lot of fun. At the same time, we learned a lot from each other. It's always fun. So listen, our listeners, do us a favor, check us out on all our social media. You've got it, Baseball Out, all on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, you name it, we're there. We do want to mention prayers to our very good friend, Phil Harrison from Slow the Game Down. He is struggling, obviously, right now with cancer, but he is a battler. He is the godfather of vision training. As you know, we've been doing vision training talks the last couple episodes. Well, it's really going to continue, and I'll talk about it, but prayers to our very good friend, Bill Harrison. Hopefully we'll have Ryan on the show one day for a second time, but right now, prayers to our good friend. And now we are going to continue our series. As you notice, the last two series have been on the vision aspect of it, but then now we're going to get, you know, when we talk about vision, we talk about timing also. You know, if you can see it, you can identify it, or you can time it. You can do a lot of things a lot better. But we're going to talk to one of the best in the business when it comes to effective velocity. He's going to explain that to us. Not only one of the best in the business, but he has been on the show a couple times, probably needs to be on the show about 10 times. Perry Husband, outstanding. Now, everybody knows Perry, so I'm going to make this very brief. You know, he basically is the pioneer in the world of baseball science. He introduced the many modern hitting metrics to baseball, including exit velocity, launch angle. We'll get into that a little bit. You know, he's a baseball player, played a College World Series, was drafted by the Twins. You know, Perry also introduced tubing in the baseball world. And that, you know, in his program where resistance belt concept was a surgical tubing product, which was introduced in Hitting is a Guest series for training hitters. A breakthrough, the groundbreaking breakthrough discovery, effective velocity. Let me tell you about it. There were countless pitching breakthroughs, including EV pitch tunnels, location adjusted speed, and many other deception metrics. You have seen him on The Great Show, which I love. I've been on every day. MLB Network. He was on with Carlos Pena. He's the author of Downright Filthy Pitching series, including four books on downright pitching. Filthy Pitching books 1, 2, and 3. You got to get those. Who basically was the Tom House was the forward on that. So let's welcome. Let's not waste any time because we want to keep our time to learning from one of the best in the business, Perry Husband. Perry, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. That's kind of a hard intro to follow up on, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a lot more because there's like 10 pages, and you know the audience already knows you really well, so I try to cut it a little short, but, you know, again, got to thank you because I know your time is limited and, you know, you've got a lot of things you're working on. So, again, thanks for being on, buddy.
Yeah, my pleasure. I love it.
All right, let's do this. You know, for our listeners, you can go back to another, and we highly recommend you go back to the other show we did with Perry. Check it out because it'll help you understand where we're going to now. But, you know, and I know it's not easy just, you know, briefly, but Let's just mention to our audience, tell our audience effective velocity. What is it? And also, how could it be used at all levels?
Well, I think at the very core level, the very first introduction to effective velocity is its reactionary speed, meaning if a pitch is thrown at 90, it really depends on where that pitch is thrown in the strike zone as to what the reaction time really is. Because if it's thrown inside, that 90 becomes closer to 92.5. And if it's thrown on the outside part of the plate, that reactionary time is at about 87.5. And that's because the hitter has to reach it at a certain place. It's like an airplane taking off, and you know, they tell you exactly when it is you're going to land, and they tell you exactly where it is that you're going to land because they know all the factors involved, you know, saving any kind of weird thing that happens during the flight. But if all goes to plan, they know exactly where it's at because there's an exact takeoff time. There's how fast you're going to go. There's effects on the way, you know, whether you're into the wind or against the wind. And then they know exactly where you're going to land. Well, in baseball forever, we've never known where we're going to land, meaning when that pitch is thrown at 90 miles an hour, we just say that's a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. But in reality, that 90 can be as fast as about 97, and it can be as slow as about 85 within the strike zone. And that's something that's crazy and hard for people to really wrap their heads around because the hitter has to reach it, and that's the landing spot. They have to be able to get the barrel to be able to move from the place that it starts at and get it all the way to the point of contact if they're going to do damage. That's one of the hard things about understanding EV. It's easy to take a 90-mile-an-hour fastball in and hit it, you know, pull your hands in and put the ball in play. But in order to do damage, you got to get to a point where you're about 2 feet out in front of home plate when you make contact with that, depending on where you're at in the box and a lot of factors. But at the end of it, the beginning stage of understanding effective velocity is understanding that wherever the ball's thrown within the strike zone or within that 6-inch area around the strike zone, it changes speeds and it either gains velocity or loses velocity based on where you have to hit it. So that's kind of like the building blocks of beginning to understand what effective velocity is all about.
That's awesome. And Perry, we're going to get into hitting his timing. And what I want to ask before we get to that with the staying on the pitching, you know, what's interesting about this is, and just let me know where I'm, you know, if I'm right or wrong here. On a basic standpoint, it sounds like a couple of things. One, if you can locate pitches in different areas of the strike zone, and especially at the younger levels, because I would assume at the younger levels, it's a lot harder to adjust to any of this when it comes to vision. And if it's location, and you just recently went to Peru, I want to thank you to help my friends down in Peru. And I was watching some of the games against the Cuban teams, and you know they don't throw very hard. And so the second part of this would be too that do pitchers have to throw hard, or is effective velocity enough to get by on winning?
Well, for sure it helps because with every mile an hour of velocity that you throw, it obviously quickens up the thinking process for hitters. Mm-hmm. So they have less time to see it. They have less time to react. But at the end of the day, it's called effective velocity because that's what it is. Some of the guys in history at the major league level, guys like Barry Zito, who threw, you know, somewhere between 86 and 90, most of his career, probably broke more bats than multiple other guys that you can imagine that throw way harder. Because when you go to the plate against someone throwing 87, 88 at the major league level, you don't expect the ball to actually be at a point where it's 92, 93 EV miles an hour. Meaning when he elevates the fastball and throws it inside, it gains about 5 miles an hour. And when it does that, hitters are taken by surprise. One of the other guys that I've heard a lot about, Jamie Moyer, was also super famous for sawing people off and breaking bats, throwing the ball at 82 to 85 miles an hour throughout, you know, the last part of his career. And the reason is because you just simply, as a hitter, speed is speed. When I watch you throw, I gauge that speed. And then the natural tendency is for me to go kind of between the two pitches that I see the most. So it doesn't matter if you throw 105 or if you throw 65. What matters, and I don't want to say that lightly, like it doesn't matter that you throw hard.
Sure.
But what I mean is it's how you use your velocity. I think Carlos Pena on MLB Network has said it many times. It's not about better stuff. It's about using your stuff better. It's about learning how to maximize all of the things. And that's probably how to summarize EV the most. How to maximize all of the deception, all the speed differentials, and being able to manage that so that you can manage hard contact.
Yeah, I like the part where you said using your stuff better. That makes a lot of sense because, you know, guys, you know, can locate really well, but just because you can locate really well does not mean effective velocity will work for you. It could actually be in the contrary.
Yeah, it's very easy to have perfectly located stuff and have it be the wrong stuff. I mean, it doesn't matter if you climb a building in record pace, it doesn't matter how efficiently you climb that ladder if when you get to the top, you find out you're on the wrong building. So you can go out on the mound, you can breathe perfectly, you can be centered, you can follow through exactly how you want, you can execute your pitch, and you can have that pitch blasted very regularly and have no idea why, because you've taken the speeds that you have, you've taken the deception that you have, and you typically, when balls are hit hard, it's because pitchers, and I'm going to give you some stats on this that are crazy. Typically, and when I say typically, I mean 90% of all hard hit balls at the major league level that we've ever studied. And trust me, that is a lot of sequences. But every study ever done, 90% of all hard hit balls are pitchers not utilizing all their tools. In other words, they're pitches that if you were a black belt in EV, you would not throw.
Wow.
90%. So only 10% of hard contact that happens at the major league level happens on EV efficient sequences, meaning they've used the EV tunnel concept where they're hiding pitches. They're making decisions. They're making hitters make decisions based on the first little bit of the flight. That's one of the other major things about EV is the discovery of pitch tunnels, meaning that a fastball is thrown, let's just say, middle up in the strike zone. And so it creates a line, right? It's on two planes. It's on a horizontal and a vertical plane.
Mm-hmm.
And if were to throw a slider off of that, just picture a right-handed batter, right-handed pitcher, and I throw a fastball that starts in the middle, and then I get a little arm side movement in towards a right-handed batter, and then I throw a slider that starts in that exact same tunnel. It starts middle, and then it ends up moving to the left as a result of the slider movement.
Mm-hmm.
So those two pitches, when it's done correctly, are going to be in the same vertical and horizontal plane. In other words, you can have it on the same vertical plane. You can throw a pitch that are stacked on top of each other. But if there's any space between them, hitters can see it. And if you're on a horizontal plane, like if you throw a fastball in and a fastball out, a 10-year-old kid can tell you which is which within about 10 feet out of your hand.
Mm.
So you have to have it on both planes. You have to have it on a horizontal and a vertical plane so that major league hitters really can't tell the difference between that fastball and that slider. So when they swing and miss at a slider, typically they're not swinging and missing at the slider. They're swinging and missing at what was a fake fastball. It looked like a fastball. It stayed in that line, the same line as the fastball, for a long period of time, and then it moved away from them. So it's losing effective speed, plus it's already slower than the fastball. So that's when pitches are efficient, it means they have that great deception, and they have more than 6 EV miles an hour between the two pitches. I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to give you an analogy. And I think this analogy is probably the easiest way to think about it.
Sure.
A football player, a defensive back, if he's charged with covering two guys and the guys are 10 yards apart, by the time what's going to happen with him is he's going to go, if you were the defensive back, you'd go right in the middle of those two receivers, because as soon as I go to throw the ball, you can read that and you have plenty of time to cover in either direction. So the natural place that you're going to go to is exactly in the middle. And then if I were to send them 20 yards apart, now you would still, you couldn't cover them both in that same way exactly, but you'd have to cheat a little bit one way or the other. And so this is kind of where analytics would come in, where you would have the ability to know that I'm going to throw 60% to one guy over versus the other guy. So you probably would lean a little bit in one direction, but you'd still stay in the middle because you still have to cover both people. So if I were to send one receiver short and then one receiver deep and 20 yards apart, now it's even more difficult to cover them both. So what you would do is back up. You'd stay in the middle because you don't want to completely let either one of them go, and you don't want to get burned on the deep guy. So you tend to cover him first, like the fastball. And that's kind of how the hitter reacts to that, is that they can't cover everything. It's physically impossible. And trust me, this is where the whole effective velocity thing started, was testing hitters to find out what they could and couldn't do. Well, we'll get back to that in another question. Now picture that receiver, or picture both receivers lining up exactly in line with each other. And then both of them run right directly towards you. And now one of them goes sharp left, one goes sharp right and deep. And so you now have no idea where they're going. That's up until the last possible second.
Sure.
And then they go to places where you can't possibly cover them. That's what a pitch is like at the major league level, when two pitches are in the same EV tunnel, and then one of them goes to the 100 mile an hour area, and the other one ends up being a curveball that's at 78 to 80 miles an hour effective speed, but they looked exactly alike coming out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
So that analogy, I hope, helps to kind of understand how you can't cover in, out, up, down, 65, 75, 85, 95, 105. You can't cover all that. So what you have to do is pick and choose which speeds you're going to try to cover. And that's where effective velocity takes each of those elements and maxes them out.
So in the major league level, they have an advantage because it sounds like they've got to use EV along with their analytics to determine tendencies. So they're using both of these, correct?
Absolutely. At least the smart ones are.
Yeah.
Trust me, there's still a lot of old school mentality. And even with analytics looks at how results happen in a very different way than effective velocity does. And so there are often discrepancies about the way you look at what's going on. And so every major league team is run by analytics now. It's only in the last few years that all of them are on board, but they're all run by analytics.
So
analytics is,
Harry, if you were using, sorry to interrupt, but if you were using both and there was that contradiction, you would stay with the effective velocity part.
100%.
Okay.
Because effective velocity is based on timing. It's based on the reality of how long do you have to react to a pitch. And analytics is based on history. In other words, they're historical. It's historical data, meaning this is how things went. And if everything stays the same, if history repeats itself, then this is what we should expect to happen. Meaning if nothing changes and everybody throws all the same things that they've always thrown, then we're going to get the same kinds of results every single year. And that's actually how it happens. It's weird, but it's actually how it happens, until someone does something crazy like Brent Strom, and he starts mixing in a huge portion of effective velocity. Well, now history is not repeating itself. Now guys are starting to utilize deception better. They're creating more tunnels. They're elevating fastballs, which increases the velocity and decreases, more importantly, the reaction time that a hitter has. And so when you have two to choose, effective velocity is the most significant by a long ways, because it is an analytic. It's the most important analytic. It's it's the timing and deception metrics. It's how to measure whether a hitter is on time or not and how much time they have to react. So it's for pitchers, it's about it's deception. It's about measuring and quantifying deception.
Wow.
And with hitters, it's about timing. It's about measuring timing. Were you early, late, or on time to that 101 EV mile an hour fastball?
Yeah.
And, and so it's extremely precise.
You know, and interesting, because I'm excited about getting to the timing aspect, because I've talked about it on the show quite a bit along with the vision. Before I do that, let me take you on a baseball outside the box question here, way outside. I mean, I'm looking at a guy like Maddox, or a guy like Moyer or Tommy John, whoever you want to mention in the past that were very successful. They obviously didn't know anything about this. They were doing something that they didn't know they were doing, unless they were just, you know, way far advanced. And where would they be if they did know this?
Well, I think someone like Maddox utilized a lot of EV principles. Bob Gibson. I mean, when you look at old film of guys that are throwing gas, where do you see the strikeouts happening on fastballs? It's not down and away.
Oh, it's up.
It's up in the strike zone, right?
Sure.
So you go look at Drysdale or Ryan or any of the hard throwers, and what you see is elevated fastballs. And what you see with a guy like Greg Maddux is that he's utilizing deception to try to max out his 89 mile an hour fastball towards the end of his career, 87, you know. I faced him in the minor leagues. He was throwing 93. So he changed pretty dramatically over the years. But he maximized movement. He was often quoted as saying, I don't want big movement. I want little movement. I want the ball to move late and barely move and just hit the end of the bat instead of missing it completely, because I can control the contact in that way. So he was a master of EV. He didn't call it EV, but he understood many of the concepts of how it works. I've heard lots of stories about him sitting in the dugout telling his teammates, this first hitter, I'm going to get him to ground out to short on the third pitch, and then go out there and actually do it, because he knew where the bat was, and he would make guys early and late based on his use of speed, his use of movement, and how that affects the reaction time of the hitter.
Wow. Well, let me tell you, he was way out there then. He was way in front of the game. And, you know, folks, we're talking to Perry Husband. You got to go to his Twitter, EV Perry Husband. Check it out. A lot of great information. Also, his website, hittingasaguest.com. Perry, you know, we encourage all our listeners to go get your products, because, you know, you've got to learn this to be able to implement it. Where do they start? Where's a coach that just getting started, or even, you know, maybe a high school coach, or it could be a college or youth league coach just getting started? Where do they start with this? Where do you recommend?
You know, the explanation of EV is far more complicated than actually the basic concepts of EV. And so there's a little bit of education that goes along with it. Books 1, 2, and 3, I split it up in 1, 2, and 3. One is a really good overview of what Downright Filthy Pitching Book 1 is, a good overview of what effective velocity is. And then Book 2 is explaining how hitters and what hitters' attention means, meaning it was a lot of the MLB studies that I did in order to back all of the findings that I had in the beginning. And then Book 3 was my attempt at trying to simplify it so that you could implement it. So if you're if you're going to buy one book, it's probably book three, Downright Filthy Pitching. If you really already kind of understand it, like it, and you want to implement it, Getting Filthy, the book, was my attempt at going back again and simplifying it even more in order to be able to implement it one thing at a time, like learning the zone and then learning how to control speed, learning about command, learning about how to create tunnels. And so it's that it just depends on where you're at in your learning curve with it. Perfect. But then I've done a bunch of online courses that I think are probably the fastest. If you really want to understand it, learn how to implement it, the Getting Filthy online course and the Advanced EV online course, those video courses are pretty, they're pretty telling.
But, and I would definitely recommend the courses. So then you can go to the website for that.
It's hittingisaguest.com.
Yep. All right, folks, we're going to have that on our show notes. Perry, on the first show, we talked a lot about effective velocity when it comes from a pitcher standpoint. And, you know, last couple of shows I've sent out on Twitter because, you know, I keep hearing on hitting and believe me, we can bounce around a little bit because the hitting part's going to also relate to the pitching. But, you know, I put a lot on Twitter. The biggest question I have on hitting, and I know we're going to get to the timing aspect with it. You know, I see people talk about hitting and, you know, I never see vision on there, you know, and I see a lot of good guys out there that know a lot of stuff, but vision, I don't know if people are scared of it, if they're not sure of it. But I've had some, you know, talks on the podcast with some experts, vision experts about this. So we've kind of addressed that and anything you want to add on vision, love to hear it. And, but you talk about hitting is timing and I, you know, I can see if you can't see it, I'm not sure how you're going to time it. And then you mentioned, you know, it's a simple support element of hitting and the least understood. I want to really get into that. So if you can get us started, that'd be great.
Greg Maddux said it really well. He goes, he was in an interview one time and he asked the interviewer, "You see that car over there? How fast is it going?" And he goes, "Never mind. You don't know. And I don't know because we have no point of reference to judge the speed of that car. Unless another car comes and we know the speed of that car, we can't judge the speed of that car very well. Now, over time, we're going to get a little better at it, but hitters can't see and react to speed very well. Because in my initial testing, that was the first place I started, was we took a bunch of players from 10 years old all the way up to like minor league players and tested them on exactly what can you see and when do you see it. And what we found was staggering, actually. It was you can throw a pitch, let it fly for 10 feet, and a 10-year-old kid can tell you instantly within 5 to 10 feet out of the hand where that ball's going. Is it going up, down, in, or out? They're 100% accurate on that.
Wow.
And so it's really easy to see direction. Which direction is that pitch going? And then the second thing that they see is they start to see spin at somewhere around 15 to 20 feet out of the hand. They start to see spin a little bit. By 30 feet, they can definitely see spin. Now, what I kept finding, though, in the spin test was that, yes, they could see it, but there was this weird delay in telling me what it was that they just saw. So you throw the pitch, and the way we did it was we would throw it into screens and you could, the ball would hit and then drop. And so they would only have a certain amount of time to recognize what the spin was. And in doing those tests, what we found was, yes, they could see spin, but I didn't think that they could do anything with it. Meaning, yeah, there's this weird delay. That's a curveball. And so I kept thinking, there's no way in real time guys are going to be able to recognize that spin and be able to react to the fact that that's a curveball, slider, fastball, cutter. And so I put it to the test. I did like 14,000 at bats with amateur kids. And we had one night a week, we had a pitcher type that threw all through the week. And every night we had five different kids show up. So we had 25 kids total in this 24-week program.
Mm-hmm.
And so one night we'd have a fastball and an obvious curveball guy. Next night we'd have a fastball and a slider guy, where the fastball and the curveball, or the fastball and the slider were hidden a little bit. They had EV tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next night we would throw a guy that had really good stuff, but his fastball and his slider did not hide. He'd throw the fastball away and the slider away. And so we had a chance to see 100 at bats every night. And so by the end of the week, we'd have 500 at bats minimum with one pitcher type. And so we could really start to see what was happening with those tunnels and what kids could actually see, but also what could they react to. And so we were judging it based on hard contact. And at the end of this 24 weeks, it was so ridiculously obvious that when hitters can see the ball pop like a curveball, they react to it really well. However, when those pitches are in the same EV tunnel, even though the spin is different, even though I know they can see spin, they can't do anything about it. And it was astounding to see that exactly what happened with that. So they see spin, but they can't do very much about it. And then the last thing they see is they start to read speed towards the end of that flight. And keeping in mind, it takes a hitter one third of the flight of the pitch to make a swing. It takes about 0.13 to about 0.15 seconds for a big league hitter to actually swing the bat. And so they have to start, if it's a fastball at 95, they have to start at about 0.267 seconds to about 0.28 seconds if they're going to have any prayer of getting around on this fastball on time. So that's how long they have to recognize the pitch. It's not 0.40 seconds, as we would talk about, and we hear that all the time. They have to react at 0.28 seconds maximum, and usually closer to about 2.67, 2.7. And so that's ridiculously fast to have to make a decision. And that's what major league hitters are doing, trying to recognize a 95-mile-an-hour fastball and be able to hit it at 100% on time. So when those players talk about vision is really misunderstood, I think, in the game of baseball and softball, because there's so much that goes on. Your eye only works at about 30 frames a second, like a video camera.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've ever done a lot of studies looking at pitches on a video camera, it's like the ball travels a foot and then there's a blank spot. And then it travels a foot, and then there's a blank spot. And so your mind kind of fills in the blank of what's in between those. So you really don't see the ball nearly as well as we might think. We see the beginning of it. We see where it's headed. We see the spin of it at some point. But really what we're looking for is trying to recognize it and then react to it on time. And so in my opinion, you really hit by memory. You recognize that looks like a fastball. And so I start to swing as though that's a fastball because I've seen millions of them. And I know where that pitch is going to end up, or at least I think I do. And so I start my swing. And when it turns out to be a slider that's coming out of that same tunnel, that's why you see such gross mistimed swings. You see it every day on Twitter. You see those overlays. Which we were the first ones to do that, by the way, way back in like 2003, learning all about this and trying to overlay pitches to show how that tunnel works. But when hitters swing and miss, they're not swinging and missing at the slider. They thought it was a curveball or slider. I mean, a fastball, and it ended up being a curveball or slider, and they swung at the fastball. And that's why they're so ridiculously early. And it's not because they didn't see it. They did see it. But what they saw was a lie. They saw the beginnings of a fastball. They started their swing, and then the fastball lied to them, and it ended up being a slider.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what goes on. It's not it's as simple as that. So when hitters talk about seeing the pitch, From my perspective, that's a whole different conversation than when you talk to a lot of other people, because I know what they're seeing. That what they're seeing is glimpses of that pitch at super fast speeds, and they're trying to recognize things, and there's some things they can recognize, and some things are very, very difficult to recognize.
You know, that explains it obviously very well when it comes to the pitching aspect, why effective velocity is so important and why it works so well. Now, I'm the hitter. What do I do about it? Hitting's got to be the hardest thing, right? I mean, if I'm a pitcher, I'm going to love knowing effective velocity, and I can work on my control and I work on my pitches, I'm doing pretty good. I already have the advantage as a pitcher, simply because of how hard hitting is. Now, what does the hitter actually do to enhance, whether it's their vision, their timing, whatever they're gonna have to enhance? Where do they start?
Well, I called my hitting program time training, because that's what it is. You're learning, and I did it in three levels. Where you learn the swing, because when you maximize your swing efficiency, you buy yourself more time. In other words, you buy yourself a margin of error for timing.
Mm-hmm.
So level one is about maximizing the physical aspects of timing. And what that means is just getting the barrel in line with the pitch for the longest period of time possible. And there's a bunch of different ways to accomplish that. But that's step one. And then level two is learning how to recognize pitches the very best way possible. And that means recognizing spin, recognizing the trajectory changes, recognizing up, down, in, or out really quickly, recognizing speed as well as you can, and actually practicing that every day instead of just saying, that's a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, guys. Go get them. And we're going to take batting practice at 60 miles an hour, and we're going to go try to hit that 90-mile-an-hour pitch tonight. That 90-mile-an-hour pitch is very different, right, in and out. And so we're going to work on specifically – where that pitch is in the strike zone, so we get it precise. So we're going to work on learning how to time pitches better, more precisely. And then the last level is, once you've gotten to the point where your swing is really sound and you can trust it, and you've learned how to recognize speed and all of the things that go with timing, now we learn how to strategize in games to be able to maximize that. And it's a bit of a process. That's why there's not very many players that are exceptionally good at it, because it's very difficult. It's not a simple thing.
Well,
it's a very in-depth process.
Let's take recognizing pitches. Let's just take that. I know we can't cover everything about it, but let's take that part. Let's say you're working on that. Are we talking about looking at fastballs, looking at curveballs, looking at sliders, then mixing it up at a certain point where you've got pitchers thrown different locations? Are we including live BP all the time? Because, as you said, you throw a ball 50 miles an hour all the time. That might work on your swing. Are we working on all these different facets? And is it more, if we do more game stuff, do we get better at this when it comes to recognizing pitches?
Absolutely, you get better. And I would recommend doing very little of traditional BP. Mm-hmm. There's a time and place for it, for hitters to get, at that low level to get their swing down and to really get the beginnings of that. But that's maybe four or five swings. Once we get to round two, we better be introducing some kind of timing element. So I'll give you a couple of drills. There's a beginning drill, and trust me on this, if you have beginning hitters, and we saw this with the kids in Peru, we had some significant increases in exit velocity in about 20 minutes. Hmm. We had some kids go from like 80 to 89. I think we had a couple 9-mile-an-hour exit velocity increases in a super short period of time. And one of the drills that we did was right now. So imagine the pitcher letting go of the ball, and at the exact moment of release, the hitter starts saying right, and as long as the ball's in the air, the right keeps going. So it's right now. And so if he throws a fastball, I'm going to tell him fastball's coming, and I want you to say right now. And now is impact. So you're gauging with your mind's eye the speed of that pitch exactly. Now, at first, it's a little tough drill because kids will start saying the right too early or too late, and they won't get it precisely. So the instructor has to know what he's doing in order to get them back on track. But immediately, you will see players have a jump in exit velocity when they start to do that.
And Perry, if I could just stop you just for a second, because a very important question here. This also, will it help you in understanding how you use your legs to ride the back leg or whatever you want to call it to actually time that pitch?
It certainly can. And it depends on your philosophy there. I have a different philosophy than most, but so if in the beginning doing the right now, let's just say that we have one speed and it's fastball away. So let's say we set it up at 85 miles an hour and I'm going to set this pitch up at 90, but I'm going to throw it away. So it's going to have a reaction time of 85 and you know that that's the speed. So we're going to do the right now drill. And so you load before the pitcher starts to get to the release point. And by the time he gets to the release point and you start saying, right, you're already at the top of your load. You've already lifted your leg or you've done that little tap move or whatever that movement is that you have as a loading mechanism. That load is happening. If you watch Altuve or anybody with a high leg kick, Jose Bautista, by the time the right starts, they're already at the very top of their leg kick. So they're starting before the pitcher gets to the release point, and they're at a place where they're ready to go right now. And so on a fastball, they load as though they're going to hit it 100 miles an hour. So if I were to do the right now drill with those guys, they'd be really, really good at it. Mm-hmm. So they'd load, and then they would see the release and go right now, and they would crush it. So now I'm going to start mixing up feeds that are different. So now I'm going to tell you in advance, I'm going to tell you what pitch is coming, but I want you to start at the same time on every load, no matter what. But I'm going to tell you right before I'm going to release it which speed I'm going to throw. So I just call it a 70, 80, 90 drill. So here comes 90, and I would start my mechanism to throw the ball. And when I get to the release point, they're already at the top of the load, and then it's, you know, right now. Carlos Pena did a thing on MLB Network. He called it and now. Mm-hmm. And so it's like load and go. And if you watch hitters that are great, the secret is in the and, is how long is your and. If I can load and go, load and go, load and go, it's the difference between what has made Jose Altuve good to Jose Altuve phenomenal is his and. And it sounds crazy, but what his and is he used to just pick up and go. He would load and go. And so he crushed fastballs. But his hard hit ball rate on off-speed pitches was terrible. He just didn't hit off-speed pitches very well because he was a load and go guy.
Sure.
And then he learned one off-season how to load and go. And in the middle of that and is when you learn how to recognize pitches. And so in this drill, you're doing 70, 80, 90. I'm telling you what's coming, but I want you to start as though it's a 100-mile-an-hour fastball or 90-mile-an-hour fastball.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I start my mechanism, you start your load, and you know that the 90 is going to, or the 70 is going to show up, let's say. So it's a slow curveball, and you're loading to a fast fastball. So it's load and go. So my and just gets longer with each pitch, depending on how slow it is.
Sure.
So that's one of the basic elements of learning how to deal with speed differentials. If you don't have that, you simply don't have any chance against guys that are throwing tunnel pitches that have any kind of speed differentials. you'll always be, the timing will always be off.
That makes 100% sense. I love that drill. And you also mentioned there was a second drill you worked on. Love for you to kind of explain that one also.
Well, that was the 70-80-90. It's like the advancement of the right now drill. So you got the right now drill that teaches you how to integrate your load with one speed.
Gotcha.
And then you introduce, now you teach your load how to recognize and deal with three speeds.
All right.
We did this drill in Peru, and it was awesome because, you know, I don't speak the language, and so we had to have a great interpreter down there. And it was funny because I would ask the kids, I was throwing live, and I would tell them what pitch is coming. Here comes 90, and I would throw it, and they would be dead late. And so I'd ask him, how do you say late? And he would respond, and then so I would say, how late were you? And he would say, I would go, a little or a lot? And he's like, a lot. So as we did this drill, we're teaching them how to recognize the fact that, yes, in my mind, I was saying 90, but I wasn't even close to being on time to 90. Mm-hmm. So by the time we finished with a kid, we had them not only making better loads, but they were also recognizing pitches and getting the barrel there on time. And it was really, really powerful to watch that.
Perry, what were you doing with these guys or anybody that you work with? And for our folks, you know, Perry's work with major league players all the way down to kids, young kids. What were you doing as far as trying to identify the pitch, you know, where to look, any kind of technique there that can help our coaches and players?
Well, yeah, there's, if you think about the way a fastball would look away, I mean, just think about the bulk of all fastballs, most of them are away, and that's helping you as a hitter. Trust me. It's okay. The reason why homers are at an all-time high is the fact that we're still throwing a ridiculous amount of pitches that are fastballs down and away. So you're taking your 95 that you worked your butt off all off season and to get to 95 miles an hour, but now you throw it in a place where it really equals 90.
Yeah, making it
slower. So all of that work has gone to naught. So now every time you throw that pitch down and away, it creates a line, right? It creates a visual line, a shape. So let's say that you have 4 inches of movement arm side in your right-handed pitcher. So if you throw the fastball in the outside part of the plate, you're going to have to throw it a couple inches outside off the plate and have it run back. So as a hitter, I'm going to learn what that looks like. I'm going to look at pitches that have that kind of action. And that's the shape and that's the visual that I'm going to look for. So once I get comfortable with the fact that that's what an outside fastball looks like, now everything else, slider, curveball, changeup, every one of those pitches that's thrown slower is going to have a different path, right? If let's just say I throw them all down and away. So the fastball is going to have a very different tunnel than all those other pitches. So when I load to that fastball and now that curveball pops up over, I'm going to be able to recognize that immediately. It doesn't mean I can do anything about it, but right. I'm going to immediately recognize it. On the pitching side, that's called a freeze pitch. On the hitting side, that's called early recognition. And right now, 20% of all hard hit balls in the big leagues happen because of that early recognition, and players have the ability to adjust to it. So in general, that's one of the reasons why homers are still at an all-time high, is because hitters are learning how to expect the ball to be the slower version of the fastball and has a different visual. And now when they see the curveball or the slider pop, they have a really good chance of adjusting to it. So and hitters have made an advancement for sure over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And
but they got a long ways to go.
Yeah, and I was going to say there is a long ways to go, especially, you know, you're seeing Major League Baseball, high strikeouts, you know, yes, lots of homers, not a lot of balls in play. You know, to me, that makes the game, you know, for me, it doesn't make it any fun, but, you know, there's not as much action. But here's you did mention, I didn't want to skip it, but I know that sometimes we tend to focus on it too much. And for many coaches, we focus only on the swing. And I get the part that the swing's important, because if you don't have the proper movement and be able to get the bat path correctly behind the ball, you know, your chances decrease even though you identify the pitch correctly. Am I heading the right direction there?
Yep. It's paramount. But, you know, at a certain point, if I were to work with a big league hitter today, I wouldn't mess with his swing at all.
Right.
He's kind of stuck with that swing. So what I would do at this moment is I would take and immediately start teaching him how to see pitches better, how to time pitches better, and then we learn how to put those things together in a game plan. It's too late to fix a big league swing in the sense that it, unless you have 3 solid months to really right. commit to that change.
Right.
It's very possible. You can change anything, but it's a long period of time to make that kind of a change.
And I'm
so the real key right now is if you already are satisfied with your swing, then it's time to turn the page and move on to the next thing. And that next thing is recognizing pitches and learning how to time pitches better.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought that up, because I wanted our younger coaches to understand they still have time to work with their players on the swing. It's just that it's not the only thing they should be working on. The next, like you said, is recognition. And then I want to get to now, which I, you know, you talk about the plan, the strategy. That was your third point. How do we put this together? And understanding this, at the major league level, they've got the statistics to help them put it together. Where at the younger levels, they don't have that. So if we can address kind of both of those, that would really help a lot.
Well, pitchers are typically similar. You could put them into categories where, and I'll give you a simple little way to think about pitchers. It's actually not super simple, but I think it'll be in the end. Picture a scale of 1 to 10. And a 5 is the very best pitcher. So maybe like a Pedro Martinez, because he can scale all the way up to 10 speed, but then also he can scale all the way down to 1 off speed. So this guy has the biggest pitch spreads, and he throws hard. And so that would be the category of the very best pitcher is a 5. So now think about Randy Johnson. He's also a 5, but he throws so many more fastballs than off speed that he kind of becomes a little bit more like a 6. So a 4, a 5, and a 6 all have the ability to be a 5, but the guy that focuses on off speed ends up being a 4, and the guy that focuses on fastballs more, let's say he throws 65 or 70% fastballs, he would go into that 6 category. So by just saying that I have 3 great pitchers, one of them's a 4, you immediately have an idea that he's going to lean a little bit more towards off speed, and the 6 is going to lean a little bit more towards the fastball, and the 5, I don't really know, because he's maximizing everything. And so that's a quick way to understand how to categorize pitchers. And so now we go to the off speed guy. They're a 1, 2, or 3. A one is like a knuckleball guy, where all he does is throw off speed. That's it. And then a 3 is the very best pitcher, because he's getting closer to a 5. He's the very best off speed guy, like a Dallas Keuchel, who's going to throw 87, 88, 90, but he's going to utilize speed really well. Maddox was probably a 3 at the end of his career, because he wasn't throwing very hard and he was maximizing off speed stuff. So if you think about off-speed pitchers, if they're 1, they're really one-dimensional. If they're a 2, they're pretty good, but they're pretty predictable. And then a 3 is the very best off-speed guy. You know you're getting off-speed, but he does a really good job of trying to mix those up and hiding pitches. And then you go to the other end of the scale, you got 8s, 9s, and 10s. A 10 is a guy that just throws nothing but fastballs, really one-dimensional. And then an 8 would be the very best pure fastball kind of guy. So He utilizes moving the ball up, down, in, and out. He understands how to maximize the use of fastball. But he probably has at least one other off-speed pitch, like a good slider, or, you know. So when you think about pitchers in general, that's a good way to kind of summarize what each type is like. And so if they're hard throwers and they don't have three or four pitches, then they're an 8, 9, or a 10. If they've got three or four pitches and they throw hard, then they're a 4, 5, or a 6. And then if they don't throw hard at all, they're a thumber, so to speak, then they're a 1, 2, or a 3. And so it's an easier way to kind of, I don't know that much about this pitcher, but I can see that he's throwing a lot of off-speed pitches in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. His fastball looks like it's away all the time. So I'm gonna say that our guy today is a 2. And so we're going to gear ourselves to learning how to battle against the 2.
No,
does that
Perry,
make sense? Is that a little much?
No, it makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you why I like what you brought that up is because for our younger, you know, even coaches and players that are listening, you know, that brings up the importance, and you mentioned it, bullpen. If you get a chance, if you can see what the pitcher's doing in the bullpen, you know, while he's warming up, when you're in the dugout, on deck circle, I mean, all that are critical aspects to preparing for the hitter and what you're saying.
Absolutely. If I get to see him take 20 pitches in the bullpen, and I see that the fastball is located away, and then I see the curveball and it's in the strike zone, let's see, throws 5 of them and only 1 was in the strike zone, that immediately gives me a decent idea. And then I see him on the game mound taking his 8 warmups, and I get to see what he's doing with those pitches. And then if I'm hitting 4th or 5th or 9th, I get to see him throw against a bunch of other guys before I get to him. And so I've seen a lot by the time it gets to my at bat. I've seen a whole lot of this guy, even though I don't have any history on him. I have some really recent history. I've seen him throw 85 pitches. If I'm the 7th hitter in a lineup, I'm seeing a lot of pitches before I actually get my at bat.
Yeah. And this helps you with what you were talking about. I mean, basically your brain is getting the information, has the information early, and now you can concentrate on identifying the pitch and maybe saying, you know, what you were talking about earlier, saying right now. Is there less thinking that goes on than when you're actually at home plate?
Yeah, I think once you get to home plate, pretty much all of that stuff is done. I'm not thinking very much about any of that by this time. I've already made all my decisions. So you do most of your homework in the on deck circle in, you know, the night before the game, you know, if you have info on a pitcher. But once you get to the box, I have a very distinct plan as to exactly what I'm hunting and exactly what my primary pitch is, what the speed of it's going to be like. I've already practiced it a bunch. And so I know that this guy throwing 82 miles an hour in high school, who's living on the outside part of the plate, he's really more like 78. So I'm going to gear my BP all for the last 2 days on 78 miles an hour. And I'm going to crush that 78. I know what it looks like. I know where it's going to be. And everything that doesn't look like that is pretty obvious. So by the time you get to a game, if you've had any prep whatsoever, it's the thinking part's done now. Now, obviously, you think within the box a little bit, but you want to minimize that because it's most of it's clutter. Most of it's getting in the way mm-hmm. of you being an athlete. So I want to learn how to compartmentalize that thinking. And yes, I need to think. Especially after a pitch, I gear for an outside fastball all day, and the first pitch is up and in the strike zone. Now I've got to rethink a little bit and say, well, maybe my scouting report was really wrong. Let's stay with my game plan one more pitch and see what happens. And boom, there comes another fastball up and in. I got the wrong intel, right? So now I'm going to have to think a little bit differently.
Sure.
So yes, there's some thinking, but it's very minimum, and it's based on what's going on and how I can learn how to, you've heard recently with Carlos Pena, he uses the term liquid analytics, which is an effective velocity term, meaning learning how to do this on the fly at game speed, learning how to apply the analytics that you know about this pitcher and being able to do it at game speed. But in reality, the thinking is more about preparation. But once I get in the box, the thinking pretty much goes out the window. And I've geared myself to what it is that I'm, how I'm going to act.
You know, that's why I think you'll see, and I'm sure you've seen it already in the game, where there's going to be a lot more training when it comes to real game situations, when it comes to hitting. Now, this has been outstanding, Perry. You know, as you know, we can do 10 hours of this. Here's the one thing I do want to do is we've talked about the hitters because I think hitting, you know, is so difficult. What did I miss asking you? Something that, you know, I should have brought up that is very important that we didn't talk about.
You know, it's impossible to cover it all. There's probably 100 things that we didn't have a chance to talk about. I would say that if we're talking to coaches and we're trying to get them to understand how to get kids on the right page, I'm going to suggest a little test that you do. Because most hitters and most coaches are under the false assumption that really good hitters can wait and see the pitch and react to it. In other words, I'm just going to go up to the plate. I'm going to see it and hit it. I don't care about any of this pitch recognition or none of that timing stuff. I know I can hit that because I've done it before. I've hit a fastball away. I've hit a fastball at 90 and then I've hit a curveball at 70, hit them both hard. So I know I can react to 20 miles an hour of speed. And this is something that I did with Tim Hires, the hitting coach for the Red Sox. So literally the best in the game right now. Way back in like 2003, we did a reactionary test. We had kids go up to the plate and we had a pitching machine that was very accurate and it was utilizing one of those big screens where it had a video of a pitcher. And then his hand would go right to the release point, and then here comes the ball. And we could program in what pitches we wanted the machine to throw, and it was very accurate. And we took these elite-level high school kids from a showcase, and we tested 200 hitters, elite high school hitters, okay? Mm-hmm. And we gave them 8 warm-up swings and then 8 swings that counted. And what we were testing was what their reactionary ability was. So we started them off with fastball away, and we had them warm up on fastball middle, and then a couple of pitches in a row at fastball away. So here's the kicker. We didn't use 90 miles an hour like they were going to see in their games. We didn't use 80 miles an hour. We used 70 miles an hour for these elite high school baseball players. And we took that 70 miles an hour and we located it primarily away. So in other words, we guided every hitter to the away fastball speed. So at 70 miles an hour, that means it's really 68. So the reactionary time. Mm-hmm. And so all these kids got used to hitting 68, and they crushed it. And then when it really counted, we moved the location to middle in. So 70 becomes 72, up and in, 70 becomes 74, and then down and away, 70 becomes 66. So what happened to these kids was they averaged 1.5 hard hit balls out of 8 through 200 hitters. Think about that for a second.
Wow.
70 mile an hour batting practice pitches, and we averaged 1.5 hard hit balls for 8 swings.
Wow.
Because the speed differential is different. It's different. It reacts different. And their brain was stuck at 68. And the pitches, none of them were at 68. They were all at either faster or slower than that speed, slightly. And just that slight differential, we broke every wood bat we had. We made them swing wood bats. And they broke every bat we had, which is unbelievable when you think about 70-mile-an-hour batting practice.
That's incredible.
But that's the reality. That's what really is going on. When you think that you can react to 20 miles an hour speed differential, yes, you can. If the pitcher takes that 90 and throws it away and it's really 85, and now he throws his slider at 80, but it leaks up a little bit and it's really 82. So now you're really facing 85 and 82. You're not facing an 80 mile an hour slider and a 90 mile an hour fastball. Even though the radar gun says 10, the reality is that the way you hit it was when it got within 3 miles an hour of effective speed, and mm-hmm. you crushed that. So that's you reacting to 3 miles an hour. That's not you reacting to 10. That's you reacting to 3. And that's mm-hmm. what's hard for people to understand. When pitchers actually keep that 10, hitters are terrible because it's hard. It's hard to go. It's hard to guard those two receivers. It's hard. It's really difficult to guard two different, completely different speeds. So what I'm going to leave you with is a test. Mm-hmm. Do this simple test with your hitters. Just have them throw batting practice to them and throw the ball up and in and say, here comes an up and in fastball. I want you to call it a 1 and I want you to hit it. So you throw about 4 or 5 of them, let them get used to it, let them crush it. If you can get exit speed, do it. And their exit speeds will be super high on that pitch. So now I'm going to throw fastballs away, and we're going to call that a 2. And I want you to crush it. Here comes 5 or 6 in a row. And test the exit velocity. And they'll crush it because they know it's coming. And now I'm going to throw you an off-speed pitch inside. So it's a 3. Again, they'll crush it. And then I'm going to throw them a slow curveball on the outside part of the plate, and that's a 4. So we've taken 4 different speeds, and we've let them crush all of them. Now, don't tell them what's coming, and just throw pitches all over the place. Randomly throw 1s, 2s, 3s, and 4s. Throw 2 1s in a row, then throw a 4, and then come back with a 2, and then come back with a 3. And what you're going to find is every single person, and I don't care what the level is, every single person will react the same way to those 4 pitches. First off, what do you think will happen to the exit velocity in that last round? It tends to go to about all the way down to sometimes 50% of their max. Wow. If you average out 10 swings, it can be as low as 50% of their max. So if they max out at 100, they can be as low as 50 when they're reacting to pitches like that with those big speed differentials. And so once you have that number, and once players see, as soon as I start reacting to pitches, dang, my average exit velocity went down 30 points.
Yeah.
50 points. Now you've just measured your reactionary ability. And now, you know, like Tim Hires and I did with these players, we measured their reactionary ability, and it wasn't very good. And most guys, it's not nearly as good as you think. And as soon as you realize that, then now you have those players' attention. So the first thing I always do is test. And so I find out exactly what that player is capable of. And now, more importantly, he knows or she knows exactly what their reactionary ability is. And so now, can you react to that? And the answer is not really. When I first started talking to Carlos Pena, he thought in his mind, I've always been a see it and hit it guy, and I really can't ever imagine myself sitting on pitches.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, let me ask you something. Are the 0-2, 1-2 counts the most reactionary counts, where you have to see it and hit it? And he said, yeah. I said, well, your batting average is 0.85 on those counts, and you're leading the league in strikeouts right now. So you tell me, are you really good at being a see it and hit it guy?
Nope.
And he had to pause for a second, like, well, maybe not. Maybe I'm not quite as good at it as I think.
Absolutely.
And so my question is, what do you have to lose? Are you going to strike out more than leading the league in strikeouts, or are you going to go lower than 085?
Yeah.
And so what happened was he tripled that 085 in two strike counts in 2009, and his strikeouts went down 25%. By learning how to think different, his batting average went up 25%, hit a homer every 8.5 at bats, and his strikeouts went down 25%. And his chase rate actually went down 2%. He was already one of the best in the league, but it went down even again. He was at 18% chase rate, hitting a homer every 8.5 at bats.
I'll tell you what, I love that. And I love the part, I mean, talk about proving exactly why this all works. I love the part that you said, it keeps the attention of, it gets the attention of the players, because those are the ones that you got to convince. Lastly, Perry, you know, the myth, there's a myth out there that you had mentioned that ground balls are bad. I just want to address this because you hear don't hit ground balls. Can you address that for us, please?
Absolutely. I did a study, and I did it for two seasons of all of major leagues, because you hear it every day. Fly balls are everything. Kids don't hit ground balls. Coaches don't teach kids to hit ground balls.
Right.
Keep the ball in the air. Get the ball in the air. All fly balls are better. All the statistics show that all fly balls are better than all ground balls. So I had to put that to the test, because that's what I do. I can't take it at its word. So I went to the database and I put in all 90-mile-an-hour fly balls. 90 is the minimum that it takes to hit it out of the yard. So, of course, we know what's going to happen to 100-mile-an-hour fly balls. They're all homers, right?
Sure.
So let's throw those out the window and let's look at all 90-mile-an-hour fly balls or less. Because when you hear a study done at the major league level, they usually put line drives and fly balls together in one bucket.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they're going to be ridiculously good. But what I did was I put fly balls, only fly balls, and infield pop-ups, because those two go together.
Sure.
And then I put 100-mile-an-hour ground balls, because these guys told us that all ground balls are bad. None of them are good. So I took the harder level of ground balls, 100 miles an hour, and I did a comparison between those two. So with the ground balls, 225 players at the big league level. And so if you think about all 30 teams with 9 guys hitting, that's 270, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 225 hitters hit 400 or higher on 100-mile-an-hour ground balls. The
wow.
mean was 550. The top was 750, meaning there were guys that put 50 balls in play and had well over a 550 batting average on 100-mile-an-hour ground balls.
Mm-hmm.
So that was number one. So then we go to the fly balls, and you look at the fly balls, and these include some home runs, because 90 miles an hour is enough to get it out. But it really covers fly balls, like fly balls that don't leave the yard. How many hitters do you think averaged 400 batting average on those 90-mile-an-hour fly balls or less?
None?
Absolutely none. Not one guy.
Wow.
And only 10 hitters hit 200. Only 10. In other words, they're outs. Fly balls are outs unless they leave the yard. They're just not as productive as we are led to believe day in and day out, unless you smoke them.
Mm-hmm.
If you hit them hard, of course they're going to be productive. But here's what happens. When you start aiming up to try to hit the ball at 30 degrees to hit that 100-mile-an-hour fly ball, you're going to have something kick in called science. And the science says that when two round things are going to collide, there's only three possibilities of what's going to happen if they hit each other. One is that they're going to hit perfectly center on center. Two, they're going to hit slightly above that center or a lot above that center. Or three, they're going to hit below that center, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how you test it, no matter how long you look at Major League Baseball, the ground ball, fly ball, line drive is almost always the same every single year. There is a breakdown of about 20% line drives, just about 40% fly balls, and about 40% ground balls. But it typically is more like 37% fly balls and 43% ground balls. So even though they're trying to swing up, when guys started telling us to stop hitting ground balls actually went up another 3%. So right now, Major League Baseball is at about 45 or 46% ground balls, about 36% fly balls, and then the line drives are somewhere hovering around 20. So there's this rule of 40-20-20. You're going to hit it 20% the way you want on that line, and then you're going to hit 4 out of every 10 up and 4 out of every 10 down on average. So what happens when you swing up? You're still going to hit those that 20-40-40, only now the 40% that you miss below the ball are ugly pop-ups. And the 40 that you miss over the ball are ugly ground balls. And those ground balls are bad. The ones where you miss hit and top it, those ground balls are bad. There's not very many hits in there either. And so the reason you're seeing all these homers in Major League Baseball is because the launch angle concept has guys swinging up so severely that now when they hit it, they hit it out of the yard. But when they miss it, and they miss it 8 out of 10, it's actually more than that, but just in general, they miss it 8 out of 10. None of those 8 have a great chance of being hits. And that's what you're seeing when you see the typical launch angle guy. You're seeing that kind of result happen. So at the end of the day, if you were to readjust that and you start looking at the guys that are really producing a lot of hard hit balls, the Jose Altuves, Josh Donaldson's, and you start looking at their swing path, it's not designed to hit 25 or 30 degree launch angle bombs.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at their launch angle and where the hits are showing up, they're showing up between 25 degrees and minus 5 degrees. Meaning, if they're aiming at about 10 degrees, now you're still going to miss those 4, but now your 4 misses all have a chance to be homers.
Mm-hmm.
And your 4 misses down below all have a chance to be 100-mile-an-hour ground balls. And so the better you aim, the better your misses are. And so it's not about what's better, ground balls or fly balls. It's inevitable, like taxes and death. You're going to hit ground balls. The key is, what kind of ground balls are you hitting? Are you hitting 100-mile-an-hour ones that average 550? Or are you hitting those little dribblers that everybody hates?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, it depends on your swing line.
Yep.
It's simple as that.
Well, I'll tell you what, Perry, I am thrilled that we addressed this. This is not over, folks, because just like those great movies or great series, you know, you're watching the TV, and all of a sudden, they don't tell you the ending, you know, and you got to come back and watch it. Well, this is going to be continued also, because we've blown the time out, and I can't thank you, Perry, because, you know, I can be here all day, but I know you got a lot of stuff to do. I really want to thank you for the time today, and folks, to be continued, because we're going to bring Perry back. Again, great stuff. Can't wait to get the show up on the website. Perry, good luck this week, and thanks again for everything that you do for us.
You're very welcome. I just want to leave you with one thing, if you don't mind. I'm going to start a club, and it's going to be, I'm going to start the pitching side first,
mm-hmm.
but I'll follow up with a hitting club also. And it's going to be something where we do some YouTube stuff, and some of that will just be free. But I'm going to do some really in-depth stuff for the guys that that end up being members, kind of a daily dose of effective velocity, and walk through some key at-bats and look at statistics like what we've talked about, and really make it so that we understand what's going on. So I'm gonna launch that in the next 4 or 5 days.
Oh, fantastic. And what we'll do is forward it to all our listeners, put it in our show notes, and we will encourage it. Because, again, when we talk about hitting and pitching, I'm not sure what's more important, and I'm going to include this with the visual aspect. But You know, I got to believe this is number one. So Perry, again, thanks, buddy. Really appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you.
That Perry Husband, again, Effective Velocity, check him out on Twitter, EV Perry Husband, on his website, hittingisaguess.com. If you didn't think this was an awesome show, I'm going to have to go back and listen to it about five times because there's so much good stuff in there. You know, at the same time, I got to take notes and, you know I missed a bunch of stuff to learn from. So, but thank you, Perry. Thank you to our producer, Brian Kroc, on the other side of the window and the Lineup Media Group. Thanks to all our listeners. You guys are awesome. For your new listeners, hope you join us on Twitter and all our social media. Also join us where you can, you know, get the show every week and get an update on the show. So you can do that on Stitcher or iTunes. Again, thank you, everybody, for being on the show. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day, and I'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.